Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Here with episode 182 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Working Together, Communities of Farmers Can Reduce Herbicide Resistance. About my conversation with Katie Densman, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Idaho and Washington State University. Densman spoke on a panel about herbicide resistance at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention in Spokane last November. She was among those featured in episode 164, entitled The Episode About the Biggest Threat to Pacific Northwest Production Agriculture 2. You can find a complete, easily searchable archive of podcasts at the new Washington Grain Commission website. Check it out. And while you're there, see the bonus feature, an episode from the archive that I think people will find interesting. This month, episode 18, called Behind the Curtain with Matthew Weaver. Weaver is Eastern Washington's Capitol Press reporter. I was impressed by Densman's approach when she spoke on the Tri-State panel because it was so different from anything I'd heard before about controlling herbicide-resistant weeds. Bottom line, she believes getting farmers to cooperate among each other is the key to controlling weed resistance, also known as chemical resistance. For those who may not understand the phenomenon, it's what happens when herbicides fail to kill a few weeds that have a slightly altered genetic makeup from their companions. Over time, those few peculiar weeds predominate, rendering the herbicide ineffective. The poster child for resistance is the herbicide Glean, from wonder to blunder in 6 years. The same thing is happening with other chemicals, even glyphosate, though not as quickly. Partly that is the result of farmers rotating herbicide modes of action. Different chemical groups kill weeds differently based on the part of the plant they attack. Rotating different modes of action helps ensure that if one herbicide doesn't kill a weed, another will, lessening the possibility of developing resistance. I know some farmers who rotate their modes of action religiously, but weeds are not static. They move with the wind, water, and birds. A farmer who does everything possible to ensure his weeds don't suffer resistance cannot succeed on his own. His neighbors must be part of the solution. As a sociologist, Densman studies the development, function, and structure of a society. Now, I've interviewed plenty of rural sociologists, but I have never run into an individual who is an agriculture sociologist. And as you'll hear ahead, there is a difference. But first, I wanted to know what motivates a person to become a sociologist, particularly a sociologist who specializes in agriculture. Densman's was a circuitous journey, but one with a specific goal of enhancing the environment.
Yeah, so I grew up in Michigan, and I did my undergraduate degree at Central Michigan University and my graduate degree at Michigan State. And I actually didn't know what sociology was before I got to college. And I was declared as a dietetics major my first semester and really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But I eventually figured out that I wanted to lean into a problem that I thought was really serious and really frightening, which was environmental degradation. So I ended up going into environmental science and double majoring in sociology because I kind of realized there was this really interesting connection between human action and society and environmental sustainability. And so that's what I did my undergraduate degree in. And then I ended up going to grad school and specializing in agricultural sociology as kind of this microcosm where people and nature interact extremely closely, and that can give us a way to understand larger issues in sustainability. And while I was in grad school, I was fortunate enough to get hired to work on a project about herbicide-resistant weeds, and that's been the last 7 years, really. So I ended up in the Pacific Northwest from a postdoc opportunity, and here I am.
All right. So you talk about the sociology of agriculture, and of course, I've heard of rural sociology, but not necessarily the sociology of agriculture. Are they different or the same?
So there is definitely a lot of overlap, but they are different things. So rural sociology is the study of society in rural areas. And that can include agriculture, but it can also extend far beyond agriculture. So, for instance, I have a colleague at University of Idaho right now who studies broadband internet access in rural communities. So rural sociology is kind of this larger umbrella, and sociology of agriculture mostly fits under it because it's the study of human dimensions of agriculture, and a lot of that work focuses on farmers. It also extends to things like agrochemical companies and extension agents and ag retailers and even consumers. And a lot of agriculture does take place in rural areas, which is where you see this overlap. But there are also people who study urban agriculture and sociology. So they're really similar, but they're not exactly the same thing.
All right. So you're currently pursuing a project that's titled Integrating Human Behavior and Agronomic Practices to Improve Food Security by Reducing the Risk and Consequence of Herbicide-Resistant Weeds. Now, in 50 words or less, what is the goal of your research?
What we want to do is give farmers the tools and resources that they need to manage herbicide resistance. Because we found that farmers want to manage their weeds right, but often have limitations like commodity prices or uncooperative neighbors. And we're trying to build this community coordination where we get everyone on the same page and can get sharing of techniques and resources.
Is there an evolution to how farmers view the challenge of herbicide resistance?
Definitely. Like I said, I've been working on this for about 6 or 7 years now. And that's actually a relatively short time span, but I've already seen a lot of changes in how farmers think about herbicide resistance. I actually conducted a national survey of corn and soybean growers in 2016, asking about their awareness and concern related to herbicide resistance. And then we did another survey in 2018 in the Pacific Northwest with very similar questions. And we saw a really significant increase in people's concern and awareness and preventative actions. And I don't necessarily think that's just a regional thing, so much as it is the fact that farmers are becoming more aware and are starting to adjust and adapt.
But don't they have a faith that there will be something else to come along to take care of the problem, that it really won't be them coming up with a solution, it will be a chemical company coming up with a solution?
Right. And that's something that I certainly have seen. I've done a lot of focus groups and interviews as well. And something that really stood out to me was there was this kind of belief in a new herbicide as the next magic bullet, the solution, in quite a few places. But there was also, in a lot of places, a burgeoning disbelief in this ability. And a lot of that were places where they'd been dealing with herbicide resistance for a while, and they weren't seeing a new herbicide come out. And one of the reasons people think a new herbicide will come out and solve the problem is because there is some historical precedent for that actually happening. And so it's not like farmers are getting this idea out of thin air. There have been herbicides that have become, or that have generated herbicide-resistant weeds in the past, and there's been something else that comes out to replace them. The reality is that's probably not going to happen anymore. And I think that you're getting a lot of people who are starting to realize that.
Okay, I absolutely agree. And I think farmers today are much more aware that they have to rotate modes of action in their chemicals. Doesn't that work?
It definitely does to an extent. And from my conversations with weed scientists, it's probably going to take more than that. And some of that is cultural practices or mechanical practices. And some of it relates to the geography of the issue as well, because even if one farmer is doing all the right things, they can get resistance from their neighbors or from chaff blowing off a truck or seeds in waterways. And so there needs to be a certain amount of buy-in from farmers in the area and also other stakeholders like public land managers to really start to get things under control.
Okay, and this segues right into my next question. We're in the midst of a COVID-19 pandemic as we speak. And we've heard two phrases frequently referring to it. One is flattening the curve and the other is herd immunity. And now I thought of those phrases in relationship to your work because I wondered how big a buy-in from the community of farmers do you need to make something like this work? I mean, is 60% sufficient to stem the problem? What is sufficient?
That is such an interesting analogy. And I'm really curious if the discourse around controlling COVID-19 will have any spillover effect into how people think about other issues like herbicide resistance. And you definitely do need a lot of buy-in. But at this point, we're not sure what that exact threshold is, whether it's 60% or something higher or something lower. A lot of research has been focused on individual farm management. And there is increasing research on community management, which is really exciting. And I've talked to some farmers doing an experiment in Oregon, actually, where they're getting together and coordinating management on one set of fields. And then there are some other fields they have that are a little more separate next to different neighbors, less coordinated management. And they're trying to get this proof of concept that if a lot of people in the same place start to manage their weeds, there's going to be this positive effect for all of them. But right now, we just don't have the information to know what that percentage is of people that need to participate.
Do you have a sense of what age of farmers want to participate?
That's a really interesting question as well, because in a lot of the focus groups that I've done, there was a father and a son, for instance, who are on the same farm. And seeing the differences in how they thought about these issues was really fascinating, because a lot of the older farmers in our group had experience managing weeds before glyphosate. They used to use a lot of integrated management techniques, and some of the younger farmers just didn't have the experience to do that necessarily. But they were also more familiar with technology than their fathers. And they were also a little more willing to take risks. They were going to be in farming for longer. They weren't as set in their ways. So there were different things that were driving responses from different age groups that were really interesting. And I think that if we could ideally get all of those different age groups to work together, that would be the best response possible.
All right. So in a paper that you wrote that I read, it appears something like 80% of farmers in the Northwest understand herbicide resistance is taking place and that resistance can move from farm to farm. I'm curious about the remaining 20%. Who are these people who don't believe this is taking place?
That's a fantastic question. And unfortunately, it is actually pretty hard to answer, because we do focus groups to try and understand that. And the people who aren't concerned are usually the people who are not coming to your focus group. So we don't get a chance to talk to them directly and ask what's going on. And that's something that I would love to pursue, to kind of talk to those people and get their opinions. And what we do know from our survey work is that the people who are unconcerned are more often the people who have no experience with herbicide resistance on their own farm. And farmers have so much on their plates at any given time that they really have to prioritize. And why prioritize an issue that you don't have yet? I mean, there's obvious answers to that question because it's coming whether you think it is or not. But even in focus groups, I've had people who tell me they know other farmers who don't have resistance yet. And the ones at the focus groups are trying to warn them and tell them what's coming, but they just don't have the capacity to deal with that and think about it until it's really on top of them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. They have so much on their mind right now, they're not going to pay attention to this one until they have to.
Exactly.
Okay, and you mentioned the surveys that you have taken. I was interested in one that the farmers talked about the weakness of this community-oriented approach was that there's a persistent misuse of herbicides by some farmers out there. And I wonder, how would you characterize that phrase? What does persistent misuse look like?
Yeah, so this isn't my phrase. It's something that farmers and other stakeholders were telling me. But they were telling me about it in a lot of different ways, which I found very interesting. People referenced application errors a lot from individual farmers not applying enough or applying too much or not at the right time. It could be sticking to one herbicide and not diversifying your program. And it could even be people who refuse to use herbicides at all because of environmental concerns. we had people bringing that up as my neighbors don't use herbicides and they are not controlling their weeds. And that was characterized as misuse as well. But what I think is that misuse of herbicides is overwhelmingly in these groups that I conduct characterized as an individual issue. And it's a way of putting the blame on a few kind of bad actors, when the reality is that it's a lot more systemic than that. It's not just the fault of people who are misusing herbicides. You have to look at the larger conditions that are causing them to use herbicides in that way and understand what kinds of pressure they're under, where they're getting their information from. I think misuse is actually a lot more complicated than, oh, that one person is just a bad farmer.
Katie, over my years as a newspaper reporter and the last 12 years with the Washington Grain Commission, I've seen farmers work together for the common good, you know, for things like schools, a swimming pool in town, protecting the Snake River dams, research at WSU. But when it comes to their farms, my experience is that telling a farmer how to farm is like telling a parent how to parent. How do you deal with that fiercely independent mindset?
Yeah, it's a really interesting contrast because farmers are extremely supportive of each other and their communities in a lot of ways. But it's a huge challenge when it comes to the idea of telling someone else how they need to farm. And that was actually one of the main themes that came out of the focus group that I did in 2016. People said it was like telling their neighbor when they needed to mow their lawn or what color to paint their truck. But even worse than that. And what also came up a lot was that farmers wanted a forum for that communication to happen, where it was something that they didn't necessarily feel comfortable going ahead and offering criticism or opinions to another farmer on their own. But if there was a venue where another farmer could ask for help or information, they would gladly give it. So part of the challenge for me and part of what I'm trying to do is create the space to have those conversations. And definitely there are some people who are unfortunately just never going to show up. So then it becomes up to the group to decide how to deal with that, whether it's incentives to get those people on board or some kind of regulation.
You're calling this community management of herbicide-resistant weeds. How long has it been around, and is there a place in the United States you can point to as the success story for the approach?
Yeah, and it kind of depends on how you're defining community management, because I think farmers have always known that your neighbor controls their weeds and how they do that is going to affect you. But this more formal concept and actual pilot programs of community management has been fairly recent. I would say it's been around maybe a decade, maybe 15 years. And there are some places in the U.S. that have been success stories to this, which is really exciting to say. There's a county in Arkansas that instituted a zero tolerance program. It was voluntary and organized by farmers with some help from University Extension, and they saw a significant reduction in herbicide-resistant pigweed under that program. There's also been some success in Georgia, and there's a pilot program in Harrison County, Iowa right now that is kind of in its infancy, so it's unclear how effective that will turn out to be, but it is happening, and just that fact is really exciting.
All right. Back in the day when I was a newspaper reporter, goat grass was this horrible weed. I mean, you know, the weed scientists were really putting a lot of effort into figuring out how to control goat grass. And then suddenly, you know, the herbicide Beyond came along and the Clearfield technology and the Clearfield wheat, and voila, you know, the problem was solved. Now, I'm wondering, you know, you're talking about this community action. I just wonder whether you're going to get into the guts of this, and then they're going to have this robotics revolution where we'll basically have little robots out there stunning the weeds or digging them up or somehow taking care of them. What do you think?
So there's actually some really interesting literature out there in sociology on mechanization and the conditions under which that occurs in different agricultural sectors. And there's some of those conditions that I think are starting to be met in weed management. And one of them is a lack of manual labor availability, especially for field crops. And then there's also a cost-benefit analysis that goes on that I think is starting to tip towards mechanization because herbicides aren't working as well. It's costing more to manage weeds that way and taking more time and effort. And at the same time, robotics are becoming more refined and decreasing in price. And those things kind of reinforce each other. So I wouldn't be super surprised to see some kind of mechanical revolution in weed control. But it definitely has to reach a certain threshold of affordability and ease. And I don't think that that's going to stunt this community management effort. Because with any weed control technique, whether that's herbicides or robotics, weeds are going to adapt. They're going to find ways to outsmart the robots, blending with crops, changing growth patterns, whatever it is. And what your neighbor is doing is still going to impact your weed management. There's still going to have to be diversity in practices and coordination throughout the community. Because we didn't do that with herbicides, which seemed fine at the time, like how robotics might be thought of now. But obviously that has landed us somewhere where we don't want to end up again.
Yes, yes, definitely. Now, I'm going to get back to this question. What kind of buy-in do we need? Do we need 100% buy-in? I think of the one rotten apple spoils the barrel. Is that the case here? I mean, do we have to get everybody within a certain area to buy into this, or is it just worthless?
I don't think you have to get absolutely everybody to buy in. I'd say don't immediately write those people off, because people do change, especially when they witness the success of others or feel social or economic pressure. So you always want the doors to be open to those people to come in and start managing as a community. But I agree that there are some people who will literally never change voluntarily, and you have to figure out if there's some kind of carrot or stick that can encourage their compliance. And I was talking to this group in Oregon that I mentioned before, and they were proposing a system to control Russian thistle, where you couldn't have more than 5 bigger than a volleyball per 100 acres. And if you complied, you got a monetary incentive. And if you didn't, you didn't. So that's one example of how they were trying to get unwilling people to participate. And it can certainly be very frustrating and annoying if there's one uninvolved farmer and it feels like they're going to spoil the effort. But I don't think they're going to throw such a huge wrench in the operation that it's not worth doing. Because enough farmers doing the right thing can probably mitigate the one who's not managing correctly. And this group in Oregon, for instance, one of the farmers I was talking to, he was one of the coordinators, and he told me this story. He said his field is at the western edge of the study area, and all of the other farms participating are to his east. And he's got a neighbor to his west that is managing his weeds really, really poorly. And what he's found is that he acts as a buffer between that neighbor and the farms to his east. Now, he'd love to get that one neighbor to change, but in the meantime, his actions are having a very positive effect on the community. And maybe he gets compensated by the farmers he's helping to protect, I don't know. But by and large, the region is seeing a very net positive impact, even with that one bad actor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a question. From the first application of a herbicide, weeds start to select for resistance. Now, the chemical companies that sell farmers their herbicides know this. What is their responsibility?
Well, there's a classic story of a specific company telling farmers that their herbicide would not cause resistance, and then, of course, it did. But companies have gotten a lot smarter about it and have really stepped up their efforts to try and get the right message out. Pretty much all of the big 5 agrochemical companies right now have web pages on integrated weed management. And they're stacking traits and working on new formulations, and they realize that it's an issue and that farmers are demanding answers. I think there's still an overwhelming focus on chemical solutions. Even when they do talk about integrated weed management, it's more in the context of rotating herbicides. And there's some disagreement within companies about how to get messaging out about integrated weed management. But our herbicide resistance education group that's working with the Weed Science Society of America is seeing more and more interest from company representatives in our work, which is really exciting. Before this whole pandemic thing, we were actually accepted to host a session at CropLife Rise. This is a big conference where a lot of these industry people would be present, and it was going to be all about consistency in messaging. So I think companies do have a really big role and responsibility, and they may have fallen short of that in some ways in the past, but we are seeing some movement towards correcting that, which is really encouraging.
Densman's right. Chemical companies of today are doing a better job of representing their products and the correct methods to use them. But it's almost as if the cow is out of the barn, isn't it? We can't change the past, but we sure can learn from it. Frankly, it would be nice if chemical companies funded Densman's research about using communities of farmers to help solve the conundrum of weed resistance. Not to mention incentives for farmers to help lead the transition. I hope you enjoyed episode 182, or what I entitled, Working Together, Communities of Farmers Can Reduce Herbicide Resistance, about my conversation with Katie Densman, agriculture sociologist and postdoctoral research associate at Washington State University and the University of Idaho. Please join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget you have the shit. We feed you.